Hey, thanks for listening to the NIL Show, a Campus Inc. production. You can catch us on YouTube, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts, and on a campus near you. If you're out there interested in being a guest or having an NIL store for your campus merch, find us on any social channel or email. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the NIL Show. I'm Adam. That's Tate. We have a lot of hot topics going on in college sports right now, so we had to bring in some cold, cold takes from Mitt Winter himself. They're not going to be cold takes. They're going to be hot takes. They're going to be great takes. That is my half-caffeinated intro to you, Mitt Winter, trying to get a tagline. Welcome back. Is this V2? Is this V3? Third appearance?
I think this is number three.
Number three. Man, we're going for it.
I think okay, if I just provide some lukewarm
pleasure being on here with Mitt, though, so it's my first one here with Mitt.
Yeah, Tate's first go around. Lukewarm takes are just fine, Mitt. We can run with that. The topic of the day, and you know, we'll see how much a lot of our conversation bears out to be true over the next 6 days, because we're recording on Wednesday, March 6th. This will probably come out next Wednesday or Tuesday or so. We'll see if we can produce this a little quicker. But the hot topic of the day is yesterday, Tuesday, March 5th, Dartmouth men's basketball officially unionizes, sending shockwaves through collegiate sports. I think some of those shockwaves probably legitimate. I think some of those shockwaves probably just a little something is happening that's never been happened or has never happened before. So all of that remains to be seen of which ones are legit and which ones aren't, but definitely a historic moment. Did you have a busy day yesterday with that news coming out, Mitt?
Talked to a lot of people about that, some media people, some school people. So yeah, it was definitely the hot topic. Although I don't think it was a surprise to anyone that they actually voted in favor of unionization. You know, they went through this whole process with the NLRB. They already had their union that they wanted to represent them lined up. So I thought it was going to turn out the way it did. I didn't know if it would be unanimous or not. And there were two people that voted no, but so the vast majority of the team voted yes. So I don't think that was surprising at all. And I also don't think it was surprising at all that Dartmouth already filed its appeal to the NLRB full board in DC. So see how that goes.
Yeah, they didn't.
Good.
They didn't pull any punches on what they were saying about how they felt the NLRB ruling went, or how they thought maybe the level of wisdom it was to try to unionize against them. They were pretty staunch.
As expected, if there is a employer-employee relationship, it's off to a bit of an awkward start, if that's what it turned out to.
Yeah.
That statement they put out like shortly after the vote, that was pretty forceful in saying that, you know, so they're not employees, basically saying we're not going to collectively bargain with them, which will be interesting because with the appeal they filed, the NLRB could stay like the effect of the vote and say you don't have to collectively bargain right now, or they could not do that, meaning that Dartmouth would have the obligation to bargain with them in good faith now while this whole appeal process is going on, which could take a while. When Northwestern did this 10 years ago, same process happened. It was appealed to the full board in DC, and it took 16 months for them to issue their decision, which was basically, we're not going to assert jurisdiction over this here right now. So it's possible, you know, could take 16 months for this appeal to happen too. And then presumably it's going to go to the federal courts and possibly the Supreme Court. So,
well,
definitely not the end of the story.
Yeah. And I think this is kind of good for people to, I don't know, wrap their minds around as casual fans or maybe not so casual fans, maybe absolute raging fanatics about college sports, that like, I can't remember exactly the year where the first Major League Baseball Players Union was formed. I think it was early 1900s, may have even been late 1800s, but you didn't have any effective or material collective bargaining until 1968, right? So like, what are we looking at here, Mitt? Obviously there's appeals and things, but just because there's a union that has formed does not automatically mean, oh my gosh, that happened on Tuesday. By next Monday, we're going to be in talks about terms and how we can work together and build this relationship. Northwestern was 16 months, but that's just even to get through the appeal process. Before you have material collective bargaining, I mean, we could be years away from that, right?
Yeah, possibly, depending on what happens with these appeals. And, you know, based on Dartmouth's statement, kind of as we said before, I doubt they're going to engage in any kind of collective bargaining right now until this is like completely appealed to the very final, you know, Supreme Court possibly. At that point, they're probably like, all right, we have to collectively bargain. But until then, I get to see them saying we're not going to collectively bargain at all, which I'm sure they've had talks with the NCAA about it as well. And they're probably like, don't collectively bargain. Because they go ahead and collectively bargain, then other athletes are going to do the same thing Dartmouth did. And then their schools might bargain with them. Then you just have that domino effect of, all right, we're bargaining now and the world hasn't ended. So
it's kind of a perfect segue into the question I wanted to get thoughts on is like, what I found so interesting about this was obviously yesterday, you know, historic day, first time it's happened. I found it so interesting that the first one came from a non-scholarship school where athletes aren't on scholarship. Obviously, you have the USC case going on, but in terms of a, you know, precedent being set from a non-scholarship school, non-scholarship team being granted that status, voting on it, how do you feel that affects, you know, the other 95% of Division I schools who are, you know, offering scholarships? Like, how does that affect the USC case, if any of you think?
I think it just makes the USC case and other cases that involve scholarship athletes stronger.
Yeah.
Because if the NLRB is saying you're an athlete and you're not even receiving scholarship, which is the biggest form of compensation that most college athletes are receiving, and they're saying you don't need that to be an employee under our legal analysis, to me, that says if you are receiving an athletic scholarship and cost of attendance payments and Alston payments, that's a stronger argument that you're an employee under that legal analysis. I think all of the factors that they looked at when saying the Dartmouth men's basketball players are employees are stronger at a place like USC or other places where the athletes are on scholarship and there's much more control being exercised over the athletes. Because if you talk about USC, football players are controlled a lot more than the basketball players are at Dartmouth.
Yep.
You guys know that.
Yeah. So a lot of questions have come around like, okay, well then what benefits are they receiving, right? Because the most tangible benefit you get as an athlete as it relates to, like, we'll call it compensation, is the scholarship. We all know you get other benefits. You get food, you get travel, there's access facilities and equipment and things like that. So as I'm reading some of this and just knowing what I have to do as an employee is pay some wonderful taxes on all of the compensation that I get. So as they're like going down this path, is part of this going to have to figure out like, hey, here is actually what compensation you do get, even though it's not scholarship, whether it be access to mental health resources or like, you know, sports psychologists and food and things. And are they then going to, they being the athletes, going to be responsible for paying taxes on that compensation? Like, how does that piece of it work? I think there's so much underneath the rocks here that people don't really understand what's actually happening.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not a tax attorney and I don't claim to be a tax expert. So on the question of whether an athlete would have to pay taxes if they're not actually receiving any cash or even an athletic scholarship, and the only compensation they're receiving is like gear. The NLRB said they receive compensation because they get preferential admissions. Is there any monetary value attached to that they'd have to pay taxes on? I don't know. There's probably obviously some tax implications, even if you're not receiving an athletic scholarship and cost of attendance and Alston payments and stuff like that. I'm not well versed enough in tax law to tell you what those implications would be, but I'm sure there are some.
And that's the point of collectively bargaining. Like, I was talking with a buddy yesterday about this and you know, he's like, well, that, like, how hard is it? And I'm like, well, it's not actually that hard. Like, as we move down this path of what we talk about CBA, what we talk about players unions, or as it relates to sports, like players associations, like this isn't new, right? Like this happens. Every NFL athlete is an employee of the NFL. Their terms of compensation and their employment contracts are very different than what most people are or have, but this model does exist. And I think that's why you have, you know, a lot of coaches like Jim Harbaugh, Chip Kelly, Patino saying like, guys, like we just have to do it this way. And Tate, you and I have talked about this. The challenge though is how do you separate football, basketball, these sports where the model does exist from track and field, men's volleyball, water polo. So is this kind of where we're seeing some push and shove with the NCAA of like, we've got to figure out how to bifurcate these two really completely different entities and be able to get to a healthy place of collectively bargaining with those who, you know, deserve it, earn it, need it, but not necessarily get to a place where we completely dismantle everything for those that don't.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one issue the NCAA, just universities have in general, is they don't want every single athlete at their school, at every level, to be declared an employee. I think if there was some magic way to just say, all right, P5 or I guess P4 football players and basketball players, or maybe Division I basketball and FBS football and maybe some other sports, you are employees, no one else is going to be an employee, then they would probably be a little more in favor of the employment model. And we might see some conferences even try and move to that model at some point. You know, the SEC and the Big Ten have their little joint advisory group, and I'm sure they've discussed scenarios like that, and maybe some other conferences have as well. So in addition to that, you also have the issue that you mentioned of, you know, at, like in the NFL and the NBA, it's easy or easier to create a players association because you just have NBA basketball players and NFL football players, and their interests are aligned. They're in the same league playing the same sport. College sports, you have lots of other sports, and they're all different in terms of the things they would want out of collective bargaining, how much revenue their sport generates, all those different things. So you have to figure out what's a players association at the college level going to look like. Is it going to be all college athletes in all sports? I don't think that's workable at all.
Yeah. And there's no Title IX for the NFL or NBA to have to buy or worry about.
Yeah, that's another complication for the college space. But I think once you get those things figured out, and there's definitely ways to do it, then I think that will make it easier for people to move forward, because these are complicated questions that take a lot of thinking and planning. So I think that's one reason that some people initially have a lot of opposition to it, because they're like, I can't wrap my head around how this is going to happen. So they're just going to throw their hands up and like, this is impossible. We can't do this. We can't change the model because of X, Y, Z. So I think it's definitely a big complicating factor, but I think those things can all be worked through.
This is such a unique time to be in sports in general. You know, college sports, obviously, because of the things we're talking about. But, you know, if you look across the pro level, I think just technology, social media, transfer of you know, feeling of ownership and rights and all of the things of the entrepreneur athlete that we're experiencing in this like cultural resurgence right now are so fascinating. But as we shift through these models, the NCAA as a whole doesn't seem to have much of a leg to stand on as it relates to like public support in the public forum, right? Like you're seeing temporary injunctions come out against the NCAA. You're seeing conversations on Twitter and like these hearings and things that are happening on Capitol Hill come out and say like, well, no, it actually doesn't make sense, your model right now. And as Dartmouth happens and USC happens and all these other things happen, people start to ask these questions like, wait, whoa, why are you trying to do this again? Like every little thing that happens and starts to come out just chips away at seemingly what that armor of the NCAA was of wanting to protect the student athlete and protect amateurism and have their best interest at heart. So it's, I think it's, for those of us that are close to it, a pretty well-known assumption that the current model is a lame duck. It's dead in the water, right? Like, we have to come up with something new. Do you see, you know, we talked about Title IX, we talked about trying to bifurcate these two different types of programs. Do you see the NCAA or college sports as a whole separating from the educational endeavors and what the institution, you know, from that campus side of things tries to accomplish? Like, do you see that as a possibility as we move forward?
I still think the athletics teams will be tied to universities always in some fashion. You know, one model that people have talked about is entire athletics departments or programs, or if it's just a few teams are spun off from university into a new entity that is partially owned or affiliated with the university, because then that would allow the athletes to be employed by private entities and you get rid of all the issues of being employees of public schools. That's another issue we didn't talk about. So that's one model that's out there. And I presume in a model like that, you know, if they're collectively bargaining with whatever league or governing entity there is at that point, whether it's the NCAA or if it's a new college football league or a college basketball league or college baseball league, whatever it is, I would presume that one of the bargaining points that entity would want is, all right, you have to be a student at your affiliated school to participate on this team.
Right.
So I think there's always going to be a connection in some capacity.
Yeah, it was funny. It was funny before we hopped in here, I was just telling my wife, I was like, oh, I'm going to hop on a podcast. She was like, oh, you going to talk about the Tennessee-Virginia case? I'm like, no, that we're on to a whole different.
Yeah, we got lots more beyond that.
She was like, what, something else happened? I'm like, come on, keep up. But we didn't even have time to record a podcast on that one, I don't think.
I know. Well, let's double dip here. You know, that temporary injunction was pretty interesting, right? Like, again, coming out against the NCAA, Judge Corker said in no uncertain terms, hey, for now, all of these, you know, temporary interim policies that you have that relate to NIL and your enforcement of controlling those activities, you can't do that anymore, short of, you know, you can't do pay for play. That's not NIL anyway. That's a skill that you are performing, a service. So you can't do pay for play. And there was one other caveat that he put in there that I can't remember off the top of my head.
Schools can't directly pay NIL compensation, and there still has to be a quid pro quo. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, the quid pro quo. We brought the expert on. That's why you're here, Mitt. So it essentially reverted us back basically to July 2021, right? Where the NCAA has no authority to govern as a governing body the policies that they've set out in place that their member institutions are supposed to follow. So, you know, as we go into transfer season for basketball, we're heading into, you know, spring games are scheduled for April 20th. It's pretty much open season for NIL right now, right? Like, do you see our collectives and schools really just starting to come together a lot more? Do you see schools saying, oh, well, we're actually just going to go ahead and do this all on our own now? Because the other important piece of that temporary injunction is that Charlie Baker came out and said, look, we will not retroactively punish or enforce these things either. So it really is like...
One thing I think isn't getting talked about enough, in all honesty, but it's really interesting to me. If I'm Florida State, I am ticked. I'm livid if I'm Florida State. So I also have to wonder if there's, you know, it's probably something happening. But I have to wonder, Mitt, what you think about if you're Florida State and I'm really the one school that's gotten hammered on this. And now you have Charlie Baker saying, oh, we're not looking into these cases anymore involving collectives. There's got to be something of an appeal that's going to be coming down the pipeline there.
I don't know if they're going to appeal it or not, but I definitely agree with you that they're like, God damn it. Why did we, you know, agree? Why didn't we fight back like Tennessee did?
Right.
I'm sure their hindsight's always 2020, but I'm sure they're kicking themselves for doing that now. I mean, to your your point, Adam, yeah, it is like open season, at least for collectives and boosters and other third parties to, you know, be out there involved in the recruiting process. Now, whether it's for high school athletes or transfer portal athletes, I mean, they're going to be like next to coaches, they're going to be the most important people out there for the recruiting process, because now they're allowed to offer specific NIL deals as part of that process. They can sit across from a recruit and their parents and be like, boom, here's our written offer. Here's how much we're going to pay you. Here's the exact things you're going to do. Recruits will presumably go and take that to another collective at a school they're being recruited by and say, here's what they're giving me. What's your offer look like?
Which was already happening before, but everything was very verbal and there was no way. At least now you can hope like, all right, if this is going to be done, you know, out it's of the shadows writing. A little bit, then at least everybody will know what's going on, because I mean, all the three of us all know, for those that haven't been in those conversations, that's happening, right? Like, I got offered this from this school or this collective, and then it's a nonstop game of trying to figure out, is that real? Did you just make that up? And nobody can ever factually, you know, find that.
Yeah, and it's sort of ironic that the NCAA, Charlie Baker said this so many times, always complained about, oh, everyone just lies and there's no transparency. That's because you didn't allow people to talk about NIL deals as part of the recruiting process. So it had to be hush-hush, all verbal. Yep. So there was no confirmation. Now that your rules can't be enforced, people can openly talk about it and be presented with actual written agreements to see what that number is, and they can talk about it openly now. So there's going to be more transparency and no more lying.
Yeah,
there's probably still some lying, but it'll be harder to get away with.
I don't know if we'll ever see a recruiting process with no lying.
Yeah. It's negotiation. It's leverage. Yeah. We'll call it leverage. And so also, shameless plug, hey, schools or collectives, sign your athletes up on the NIL store, get them squared away, let them know the opportunity. No need to be concerned about pointing them our direction and any appearance of impropriety. Little shameless plug there. But it's really interesting as we kind of unravel all of these that, you know, again, we talked about it briefly, but all of the governing responsibilities of the governing body of collegiate sports are seen to be either, hey, you can't do that, or whoa, you shouldn't do that, or you're not allowed to do that, or we don't want you to do that. So, you know, as we kind of barrel towards this new future, I know you're on advisory capacity with athletes.org. We had Dave on last week. Is an organization like, you know, are they excited? Or like, how do we, there's a lot of challenges to be overcome and a lot of timeline ahead of us, but this is essentially the environment that AO is it brought into existence to help with. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, athletes.org wants to be the players association for college athletes. And that's not just football players or basketball players. It's all college athletes. And then it's, you know, it's going to group them into chapters. So like SEC football players who have the same types of issues and interests, basketball players, Big Ten women's volleyball players, you know, that's how AO wants to group athletes, which, as we kind of talked about before, makes a lot of sense, because the issues that a women's volleyball player is facing are not the same that DC football player is facing in terms of revenue and all the different things that they want out of their athletics experience. I mean, it's perfect timing for what AO is trying to do with all the other things that are going on out in the college sports world right now. And so AO is there to support athletes in moving forward in this new world of college athletics.
Yeah, it is definitely a new world. What that world will shake out to be, if any of us really knew, I don't think we'd be on this podcast. I think we'd be in some boardroom somewhere or on some beach somewhere. But that's, you know, that's the exciting part about our jobs right now. I was telling Tate yesterday, it's like, man, if anybody knows which direction this is going to go, and you could let me know, I'd much appreciate it. But it's an exciting time. And, you know, we always talk about look, how many opportunities do you get in your career to have something shake up as big as this has been shaking up college sports?
And I can't wait for the tell-all books in 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. But more often than that, or more important than that, it's like, look, this is an opportunity to get it right and to maybe right some wrongs. Maybe there aren't as many wrongs out there. Maybe there are more than we think. Regardless, the idea now is let's put a model together in place with the appropriate parties that is sustainable for the future as sports grow. Title IX is the biggest thing to happen for women in higher education and sports in the last, probably in history. NIL is that next thing. So let's make sure as we build this model, we get it right for not just today, not just what football and basketball and women's basketball looks like today, but that we get it right for the future generations as they continue to, you know, to grow as women's volleyball grows, as softball continues to grow. So I'm grateful for people like you, Mitt, who have that perspective, as well as many of our other partners. But we definitely have our work cut out for us in the next 6 months to 6 years.
Definitely. I think that's a great point that you raised. You know, a lot of people who are kind of advocating or saying that college athletics needs a new model, people will say, oh, you're trying to kill college sports. No, one's trying to kill college sports. People are trying to push it to a model that it needs to be pushed to, because otherwise courts and other entities are going to build that model for them. So we're like, hey, this is what's going to happen if you just keep moving on the same path that you're on right now. Let's figure out the model that works for everyone, and let's do it now instead of just sitting around. And in 5 years, you're going to have the court saying, here's what you need to do, and you're not ready for it again, like happened with NIL.
Yeah,
exactly.
I agree more. I'd rather have the people who understand the industry, understand the experiences of athletes, of schools. I would rather us create the industry rather than, like you said, it get made by courts and politicians who haven't spent a day in the industry or know what it actually looks like. So
my dad is he's an athletics director, former collegiate coach. So I'll give you some Coach Cook advice right now. Make a decision or have it made for you.
Yeah.
That is where we're at. Well, Mitt, I am so grateful for the time. As always, you're a pleasure to have on here. Your perspective is wonderful. Again, at Winter Sports Law. Mitt Winter Sports Law? Winter Sports Law?
Just at Winter Sports Law.
At Winter Sports Law on Twitter. Please follow. Read where he's at. Incredible insights. Grateful for the time. I'm Adam. That's Tate. This is another episode of the NIL Show. We will catch you guys next time. Hi, everybody. Adam Cook from Campus Inc. in the NIL store. Want to say real quickly, thank you so much for listening and joining us on this journey. And as a reminder, if you ever need any custom merchandise, youth jerseys, camp t-shirts, whatever it may be, you can always find us at campus.inc. And of course, for all your NIL needs, nil.store. We're going to jump into the episode. I hope you enjoy.